Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in this week. As always, yeah, friends, if you're listening here on the radio, today is, of course, the day here in the United States that we honor those who have served in the military, Veterans Day, and we here at NOLA Drinks tip our cap to you and raise a toast to you. Thanks for doing what you do, being the heroes that you are. Friends, we got a really good show coming up for you here today. Our featured interview is with Lizzie Asher, and Lizzie is one half of the sibling duo, along with her sister Melanie, who run Machu Pisco, a very fine Pisco producer. If you've been listening to the show, and I hope you have, we've done different shows, various shows over the past two and a half years on Pisco. It's one of my favorite spirits, not only because it's tasty and wonderful, but also because the cultural connection, the cultural importance that it represents for Peru is a really fascinating story. If you want to go back and go to our website, noladrinks.com, and just Google, or excuse me, don't Google, use our search bar and just type in Pisco, P-I-S-C-O, and you can see some of the various shows we've done, including some pretty extensive conversations on history. It's a fascinating, fascinating tale. We do touch on some of that with Lizzie, but we talk about some things from some different angles. Of course, we talk about their brand. We sip through some things. We talk about what it's like to be two women in the industry. She runs a lot of the business side. Her sister, Melanie, is the master distiller. We talk about some environmental things, different considerations, and just a lot of interesting stories about Pisco, their family connection to it. Some really, really fascinating stuff. So I hope you enjoy that. If you are listening here on the radio, I do encourage you to get the podcast. Why? Well, we do an extended podcast conversation every week, and it's called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, and you can only get it on the podcast. The podcast is available on your favorite podcast network, Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn Radio, a couple other ones. So yeah, go check that out if you need to find those links. Can't remember what I just said? I can't remember what I just said. Just go visit noladrinks.com. The links will be there to all of the platforms in which you can find the show, all of our social media links, and you can even stream, download, and subscribe to the podcast right there on our website. Each episode has its own post. You can browse by topic and all kinds of cool stuff like that. So anyway, I do encourage you to go check out the podcast. Lizzie sticks around and chats with us for a while longer, as most of our guests do when we have them on the show, and it's some really fun conversation that we have there. Friends, we also have some really good shows coming up. We've got a few things to work out with the exact order of when they're going to air. But among other things, we're going to be talking to the folks behind Tales of the Cocktail. They just made an announcement recently that they're doing their Tales on Tour. This is when they do the event once a year somewhere besides New Orleans. And they're doing it this year in Puerto Rico, which I think is a great choice. We're going to talk to them about stuff like that, community involvement, all kinds of other things that they have going on. We're going to be chatting in another show coming up with Paul Hletko, who is the founder of the fine distillery up in Chicago, Few Spirits. Some really cool stuff. Paul's a good dude. Had him on the show about a year ago. Look forward to having him back on. We're also going to be working with our friends at French Quarter Festival and doing a show coming up pretty soon talking about the Revillon tradition and the Revillon dinners and the Revillon on the Rocks, the drinks program that they do coming up in the holidays. Now, if you're from New Orleans, you may know what the tradition is and you may know something about it, or you may not. And if you're not from New Orleans, you maybe don't even know what it is, but it's a really interesting tradition that dates back a long time here in New Orleans, and it's kind of been recently revived, if you will, doing some different things at French Quarter Festival and some of the friends at New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation puts on to do price-fixed meals around town. But we are going to have an historian on, which I'm really excited about, who's going to be talking about the actual tradition and history of Revillon dinner. So that'll be a neat show coming up, and all kinds of other cool stuff. So friends, what we're going to do, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. When we come back, we're going to chat with Lizzie Asher from Machu Pisco. Come on back.
Well, after I'm through this bottle of wine, I'm gonna take you out, girl, and spend some time.
Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit sawineweeknola.com. Cheers, y'all. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yeah, friends, thanks for listening in this week, as always, to the show. And we are going to start talking about, as you know, one of my very favorite things in the world. We're going to be talking about Pisco, and I am very pleased to be joined by Lizzie Asher, who is, along with her sister Melanie, the proprietors, owners of a fabulous brand of Pisco, Machu Pisco. Lizzie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian.
How are you?
Great to be here. Oh, super excited. Super excited to be talking Pisco. What else?
That's great. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your enthusiasm, Lizzie, coming on. I'll let listeners know, because we're very honest and transparent here on the show. You and I have been shooting the breeze for about the past 40 minutes. So it doesn't have to sound like, you know, we just came in. Hey, nice to meet you, Lizzie. How are you? Welcome to the show.
We've already
been waxing philosophical about Pisco for a while and other things, which is great. People are going to see right through that, Lizzie. So let's just put that aside. But it's great having you on the show.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And you and I had the opportunity to meet pretty briefly, but at Tales of the Cocktail here in New Orleans this past year. But it was right at the very end of the event. And, you know, as listeners know to the show regularly, we've talked about Pisco on the show before, but this is the first time that we've had you on the show, which I'm really, really excited about. And just talking about Pisco. And you're up there in New York, just so people know. You're not down there in Peru. But your sister Melanie, who is your master distiller, spends time going back and forth. How often, Lizzie, do you get down to Peru?
Actually, I don't get down to Peru much often anymore, because one of the things that we've realized, having both Melanie and myself out of pocket simultaneously, is not such a good thing to happen to much Pisco the company, especially because down in Pisco land, communications is a little bit more challenging. And as much as you think you can navigate life, from your iPhone or Android or whatever it might be, believe it or not, you sit in front of your computer and you look at your inbox and you're like, oh my God, it's like, you know, a 20-foot wave just lands on you and it's like, oh, killer. So
right.
So as not to drop balls, you know, we basically make sure one of us is always in pocket and managing everything. And the truth is, as much as I'd love to go down to Peru, and I will be in December, really, Melanie's talents are the talents that are needed to make our beautiful Pisco. So,
got it. There's a practicality.
She gets, yeah, exactly. It's just the reality of the situation. She's got the talented taste buds. I do not.
I don't buy that entirely. But as you said, she's the master distiller and you're the attorney in the group. So everybody plays an equal part in this and a necessary part in this. But let me ask you this question, Melanie. Let's talk about this, because it's not really a question. Let's talk about, for listeners, and if people have listened to the show before, which I hope they have, we've talked about Pisco before, but let's tell people just kind of in a nutshell version here. People are gathering Pisco comes from Peru, but what is Pisco? It's a grape distillate. And then what should we know about it from there?
Well, what I always say to people is Pisco is the spirit of Peru. And it's, you know, very much like tequila is to the people of Mexico. Pisco is the heart and soul, the liquid heart and soul of Peruvians. Mm-hmm. It's our national spirit. We have multiple holidays during the year to celebrate it. And, you know, not that we have to create more reasons to try to imbibe it. I like to say it's our liquid heart and soul. But most importantly, you know, for newcomers, I always say, because, you know, that might leave some people stumped, like, okay, what do I do with that? But I always say, well, think about it this way. It's just like gin and vodka. It's just a white spirit, but it's made from grapes. And people are like, oh, okay, Mm-hmm. That's a, you know, a little bit easier to kind of wrap your head around if you haven't been lucky enough to taste Pisco yet.
Well, that's a great explanation. Now, some people out there may be going, and I know probably some people are going, yeah, I already know what it is. But for those that don't, some people at this point might say, well, yeah, that sounds like brandy to me. But that it's quite a bit different, right? It's a much more unadulterated version of a grape distillate. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yes, actually, that is a fair way to put it. Although technically, and I'll use the word technically because, as you said, I am the lawyer. Pisco does fall within the ambit and the umbrella of brandy, mm-hmm. because brandies are just grape distillates. It just happens to be that in Peru we have a lot of rules and regulations guided by our denomination of origin that producers must stick with. That don't allow us to be maybe as adventurous as some of our techniques as other fruit brandies might.
Right, and no wood, right? You can't age something
exactly.
in wood.
Exactly, that's the most to the point. That's exactly what I'm getting to.
Yeah.
Correct. There is already one country that excels in making a grape brandy that is aged in wood, and that would be France.
There you go.
Exactly. So there's no reason why to try to replicate that. And I think Peru is making an entirely unique product from grapes that are incredibly terroir driven, and especially the Quebranta grape, which grows nowhere else in the world but Peru. So why not try to bring that to the world and, you know, exploit our uniqueness rather than trying to replicate somebody's, you know, somebody's heritage.
This is a great point. You actually anticipated where I wanted to go, because I think that Pisco, one of the things that I really love about it is that it is, as far as a spirit goes, a distillate goes, it is maybe the finest example, or certainly one of the finest examples, if not, of a spirit that is so terroir driven because of the fact the way it's, you know, the grapes that are grown reflect their terroir, and the production methods, because you're not aging stuff in wood, you're not adding water and things like this. So you're actually seeing the terroir shine through, and you get a sense of place when you drink Pisco, and you see the variation of terroir within the Ica Valley where it's grown, correct?
Oh my gosh, yes. But, you know, actually the Pisco Valley is not the only place where Peruvian Pisco grapes can grow.
Okay.
In fact, there are five pockets of Pisco growing grapes within Peru. It happens to be that that right now in the U.S., all the Peruvian Piscos that are found here are from the Pisco Valley.
Okay.
So either the around the Ica, or where we also have our production and grow our grapes, and which is the town of Chincha.
Okay.
So those are the two primary areas within the Pisco Valley. But there are other areas. One is outside of Lima, as an example. Another one is in Arequipa, which is at higher altitude. So as I always say to people, I mean, what is happening with Pisco right now here in the U.S.? I mean, we're not even scratching the surface. To be honest, we're not even seeing the tip of the iceberg at this point. Right now in the U.S., yes, you can find Piscos that represent the three styles in which Pisco can be made, which are puros, mm-hmm. Single varietal Piscos, acholados, which are blends of different grapes, and mosto verdes, which is a very unique process by which this type of Pisco is made. So those three styles are represented.
Okay, and just really, Lizzie, sorry to interrupt there really quickly. So when we say puro, so it's a single varietal pure, right? So it's a single varietal Pisco. With acholado, it's a blend. So any of, what is it, about eight or so grapes can be used in whatever combination.
Yeah.
And then the mosto verde, which is a very unique style. If I understand correctly, this is where fermentation is actually stopped while there's still some residual sugar going on. So that's going to kind of help with the mouthfeel and create a bit of a different experience, is correct? Different taste, different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So if you think about it, we're talking about three styles. There are eight different grapes, right? And we're talking about five different regions. And we're talking about hundreds of producers. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
I mean, the multiplicity of all those combinations is enormous. So I always say to people, drink pisco just like gin or vodka, but eventually we're going to really have to think of it very much like we think of wine mm-hmm. and its complexity, just in order to really explore the breadth and of diversity within the category in Peru.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because I think if you kind of unpack what we just said, aside from the three styles, let's think about that. You've got 8 grapes to play with. You can do a single varietal. You can do a blend, or you can do the mosto verde, which means green must. You can do that process. And so you've got all these variables that you can kind of play with. And then when you plug in the fact that you can then look at the terroir from where the different grape varietals come from, there's a lot of different colors on the painting palette here. And I think it's really interesting to taste a lot of these side by side, which I've had the great pleasure of doing on numerous occasions, because you go, wow, it is. It's like a wine. The variation across the different producers, the different grapes, and the different styles is considerable.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, even, for example, I think people who love Napa Valley, even, you know, within Napa, there are some producers that are known for a specific qualities in their wine. Well, the same thing ends up happening.
All right, Lizzie, so sorry we kind of dropped the call there for a second, but the last thing we were just talking about there was, like Napa, people associate themselves with a different style, different grape varietals, and different terroir. And we're seeing the same thing with Pisco, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that every distiller has a specific, you know, approach to their grapes, where it's, you know, it could be that it starts even in the grape field. So if my sister is very finicky about hand picking all her grapes, to be honest, she's finicky every step of the way.
That's why she's the master distiller. We need that.
yes. Believe it or not, 1 year she made sure to actually, when I was pregnant, you know, and we were reading about, play Mozart to your baby. She decided to play Mozart to help the yeast be in harmony when they were fermenting the malt.
Oh, I like it. And not even playing it to the grapes. She was playing it to the yeast on the grapes, which is, that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, they're living, as she said, it's a living organism. They should also be able to react.
Right.
To the melody.
That's really funny. So we're talking about...
Did I not say she was finicky?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. That's great. So we're talking about a very interesting, very clean distillate that allows that terroir to shine through like we've talked about. One thing that if we can explain briefly, and we'll take a little break after that, Lizzie, because I know you got to get in an elevator, and then we're going to pick the conversation back up. But... grapes, the 8 varietals are divided into 2 categories, and I think maybe sometimes kind of misleading to people, non-aromatic and aromatic. Can you kind of briefly explain what that means?
Sure. And you're right. And it is a little bit misleading, especially, I think, because, as an example, our brand, Machu Pisco, is our brand that represents our single varietal Pisco. And as an ode to really Peru and the terroir and the genesis of Pisco, our single varietal Pisco represents the Cabanta grape. And so when I first, you know, I'm talking to people and tasting them, the first thing that they want to do is really dip their nose into their flight of the Machu Pisco, and they try to whiff for the Cabanta, and they're like, not exactly what I was anticipating. You know, your brain tricks you. Like, what is it that you're thinking? And, you know, to be honest with me, when I was just learning, I'm like, ooh, great. Let me get a whiff of Welch's here. hopefully people are far more sophisticated than me when I started all of this. But Quebranta, although it is one of the 4 deemed one of the 4 non-aromatic grapes, it is deemed that only because in comparison to what are actually the aromatic grapes, they are so floral and fragrant and in your face, that the other ones that are more muted and whose notes are maybe more grassy, herbal, earthy, they don't jump out of the glass at you. And so it's really to just, it's a point of contrast. More than a literal I think, definition and characterization of the grape.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because I think, you know, you could kind of argue that we have the, you know, the aromatic or smelly ones, and then we have the super aromatic or super smelly ones, might be, you know, but that's why I don't do marketing, so don't listen to me. But let's let's do this, Lizzie. Let's take a little break here on the show for a commercial, and then we're going to come back. We're going to chat a little bit more about your brand, Machu Picchu, and a little bit more about your story, you and your sister, and we're going to talk about being women working in the industry, and then if you stick around for the podcast only portion, we're going to even have more fun. So friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA
awesome.
Drink Show. Yeah, cool, Lizzie. So we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. We're chatting with Lizzie Asher from Machu Picchu. Come on back.
Oyster rake scraping down Grand Isle Way. Goodbye, Joe. I got to go. Me oh my.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for listening in, as always. And yes, we are chatting with Lizzie Asher, who is one half of the sibling duo, along with her sister Melanie, behind Machu Picchu. And Lizzie, thanks for sticking around for the show here and chatting with me all the way up there in New York.
Gladly, Brian.
Yeah, having a lot of fun talking with you today. Let's talk about, how did you and your sister get involved in the world of Picchu making?
Well, I have to admit, you know, I wasn't the ingenious one. This is all my sister's idea. This has been her dream and passion for a good couple of decades now, actually, believe it or not. Since one of our trips when we were headed back in to Peru, we were visiting our grandmother, and our family tradition post-church was always have these big, giant family luncheons, and one day basically and during those luncheons we would have, you know, these huge jars and of Picchu sour come out, much the same way, you know, people love to pour lemonade during summer lunches where we have, you know, all this Picchu sour flowing. And Melanie decided to pour some Picchu sour in her ice cream, and she just thought that was the most delicious thing she had ever seen.
Now how old was she? How old were you all at this time, roughly?
Around 12.
Okay, right on. See, this is way cooler than lemonade at a summer picnic. I'm liking the piece. Go on. Sorry.
I know. I think she was, you know, Picchu discoing it, you know, very early on. but, you know, hey, it's, you know, but vanilla ice cream is pretty good, but with a dash of Picchu, it's even better.
I like it.
It literally just stuck. And, you know, she went to college, and even her thesis was about comparing the temperance movement in the U.S. versus Peru and the temperance movement in France. And then she went to work at Wall Street, and she worked, you know, in Aldi and the Sky Vodka deal and Jose Cuervo and all this stuff. And then she went into business school, and, you know, the bug was still firmly in place saying, make Picchu, make Picchu, make Picchu. So her second year when she was at Harvard Business School, one of her classes was dedicated actually to creating the business plan for the company.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
Yeah. And lo and behold, she had a sister who was a lawyer and, you know, could donate free labor, part of my pro bono work.
Right. Well, we know the expression, exploitation begins at home. So there you go.
Exactly. Did I not say we were a family business? All the way to my aunt doing, you know, quality control.
So, oh, right on, aunt. I want her job. There you go. Was she quick to sign up?
Yeah, no. I promise you, even, you know, our La Diablada, which is our Achelada brand, was a collaboration between Melanie and our grandmother. So we have this amazing picture of grandma when she's 94, and we won the gold medal in Peru, and grandma's really proudly holding her medal. So,
oh, that's cool. Well, let me ask you this, Lizzie, because
yeah,
I maybe didn't hear my one question. So was when your aunt got involved in doing quality control, was she quick to accept the assignment?
Oh, yes, she is. She was, and she is to this day. But believe it or not, not just tasting, actually, believe it or not, we never have bottled until this year will be the first year because Grandma passed away, but we never bottled La Diablada until Grandma had the first taste.
Okay.
Because, yeah, but Sia Rossi is not just about liquid quality control, actually. It's about even down to, like, the minutia of the boxes and the alignment of the labels and, you know, everything. So everybody's talents, you know, have, you know, a great welcome in the company. So
cool.
We were talking about PR and marketing before, and that's the expertise of mom because she gets to brag about her daughter.
See, perfect. There's a truth. Yeah, there's truth in marketing, right?
Well, <Exactly. laughs>
well, Lizzie, let's tell me, because I want to get to the La Diablada probably in the next segment, but in this segment, kind of your main go-to brand, I think the first one y'all had on the market, if I'm not mistaken, is the Machu Pisco, which is a puro, as we talked about, a pure, and it's a quebranta. Can you tell us a little bit more about that one?
Yes, but just really quickly, I will tell you, actually, our first pisco in the market was not Machu Pisco. It was actually La Diablada.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yes. So we were actually the first super premium pisco to leave Peru and enter the U.S. market after pisco had been dormant for, my gosh, you know, decades upon decades since Prohibition.
Yep. Wow.
So,
But
you're right. Machu Pisco is our single varietal pisco. It is represents the puro category in Peru. And we chose to make our puro from quebranta as an ode, you know, to this grape that really defines the Pisco Valley and, you know, this amazing 400-year story. It's really a love story of pisco and the terroir and this desert valley in Peru.
Yeah, and it's and we talked you touched on this in the first segment, Lizzie, that quebranta is a uniquely Peruvian grape. If I'm not mistaken, it's a mutation, so probably you know, grapes that were brought over from vinifera from Europe, which we don't have to go into this because we've talked about that on previous shows, but it has become unique. The point here is that it has become uniquely Peruvian, and there's a reason why it's kind of the backbone grape to a lot of piscos, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And actually something that, you know, people think we're very witty and all calling our puro Machu Pisco. And they're like, oh, yeah, Machu Pisco, Machu Picchu. Ha, 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 I'll never forget that. And what I always tell them, you know, and maybe many people might know, obviously, that's a grape, as you said, that came from Spain when the Spaniards brought it over. But I always tell people, actually, the reason we chose the name Machu Pisco, not only because it's catchy and hopefully you have a point of reference, but because actually Machu Picchu was the first point of agriculture in the New World. When those vines were first brought over, mm-hmm. the Spaniards were inspired because the Incas farmed in terraces. And when they saw the terraces, they were like, oh, we could bring vines here. So the vines that were brought, the first vines brought over to the New World were planted around Machu Picchu.
Right.
And then when the winters came and the, you know, at such high altitude, it got too cold for those vines. So in order to rescue those vines, they were taken down to the Pisco Valley where pre-Incan civilization had built aqueducts.
Okay.
So that's the entry, and really Machu Pisco for us also has, you know, a historical relevance in terms of the name and the place, you know, to go back to the roots of viticulture in our hemisphere.
That's really cool. So it's not just kitschy. And I think maybe, and again, we don't have to talk too much about the history of this, but, you know, people maybe don't know this, but, you know, commercial wine production, at least in some form, goes back in Peru to the mid-16th century. So there's a longstanding tradition of wine production and grape growing, an effort in that regard for centuries. And it is a long-rooted cultural component of the country and the landscape, isn't it, Lizzie?
Oh, very much so. And in fact, actually, the grapes were really brought over for wine production because it was too expensive to keep bringing wine from the old world to the new world.
Right.
And so the idea was really to do a cost savings. And what ended up happening was Peru started making enough wine that it could actually end up being exported back to Spain. So King Ferdinand was lobbied by the wine producers in Spain to prohibit the production of wine in the New World.
Ah.
And in fact, Yes, and in fact, that's what came to pass. So all wine production was prohibited in what used to be the Incan Empire in Peru. And what were we to do? We now had, productive vines. We knew how to make wine. And lo and behold, as priests tend to do, they come in and they save the day with their great knowledge of distillation. So we had some Dutch priests come to Peru, and basically we were able to make, from our, lost wine production, we were actually able to use the grapes to make the grape distillate that we call Pisco today.
There you go. Okay, and let's do this, Lizzie. We're going to take a little break, and I'm going to make a very bad joke because, you can imagine the priests, they're not saying raise the roof, they're saying raise the proof. And so that's what they decided to do, right? And we're going to let that go. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. That was awful. And then we're going to come back and taste through some more things. Friends, we're chatting with Lizzie Asher from Machu Picchu. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. So we went to a house on Rampart Street. Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit sawineweeknola.com. Cheers, y'all.
Well, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Well, I'm standing on a corner with the bucket in my hand. I'm just looking for a woman that ain't got no man. My bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Yes, Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. It is a pleasure to be chatting with Lizzie Asher, who is with Machu Picchu, along with her sister, Melanie, and we're having a great laugh. And as always, friends, here on the NOLA Drink Show, I wish I could share with you the conversations that take place during the commercial breaks and these things. We are comparing notes on how properly to swear in Spanish. I'm going to leave it that way. We're not going to go any further than that, because even though it's Spanish, we'll still get in trouble with the FCC here. But we're sipping right now, Lizzie, on, we were talking about this before we took the break, on the Machu Picchu, and we got that story, but this is made from the Quebranta grape. I think it's a really, really nice, easily approachable, just it's a great sipper right out of the gate. I get a really nice slaty note on it. I get a little citrus note on it. I get a pepper note on it. And I kind of get a little bit of a baking spice, but more of like a cinnamon kind of nutmeg note on it.
Yeah. And you know what? It's funny that you would say that because, well, two things. To me, actually, a Quebranta, if you were to travel to Peru and order a pisco sour, 9 out of 10 times you will be given a pisco sour made with a puro of Quebranta, which is why it was so important for us to have our, puro out of the gate be a Quebranta puro. But most importantly for me, and when you were talking about those kind of spice notes, is that during the winter, two things that I like to do to my two favorite cocktails, pisco cocktails, which is a Machu Picchu. So in Peru, instead of using sometimes bitters to top our pisco sour, as we do during the summers, so we actually spray a little cinnamon powder on top.
Oh, yeah.
Bring
okay.
up those notes. Yeah. And for me, because I love a pisco punch, is that what I like to do is actually draw 4 sticks of cinnamon into my bottle of Machu Picchu before I make my pisco punch. And, okay. Oh, my gosh, cinnamon and clove. Oh, they come out beautiful. Star of anise. I always actually adorn my punch bowl with stars of anise. And all of those blend beautiful with the Quebranta. We said that it was a non-aromatic. But, as we also said, it's a misnomer. But a way to really bring out those notes and make them really salient. Oh, yeah, winterize your Pisco Pancho dot.
That's awesome. And actually, it makes sense to me with the quebrada because of what you're saying. Like, and on yours in particular, like I said, we're getting a bit of a peppery note, kind of a slaty note, or maybe, you know, like slate or pencil shaving, or maybe, you know, even kind of an earthy note, I think. And that's going to kind of punch through, I think, a lot of what you're talking about, right? And that makes sense as to why what you're suggesting would work.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we went to break, one of the things that you were saying about the quebranta is that, you know, it just has such a strong body. And in a way, I think that that's exactly why you really find the quebranta grape so much, even in the acholados. Even when you're blending different grapes, you always find a good portion of it be the quebranta grape because, you know, it helps your cocktail stand up to so many ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it shines beautifully with different citrus fruits, you know, holds up incredibly well with actually coffee. Oh my God.
That's a great idea.
It makes some great coffee cocktails. That goes without a doubt. Oh my God, are you kidding? You can make your hot toddy with it. If you really, you know, want to take it in that direction of really winter cocktails as the winter months are actually coming upon us soon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not just citrus for the summer, but some of the heavier winter notes are amazing with the quebranta. And especially now that it's the fall and pear. I love pears in the fall and I love that flavor profile and the pear with the quebranta. Oh, it's all sorts of yumminess.
You know, that sounds, I think would sound really great to me right now, since you're mentioning this, is that we could do a variation on a martini, take some fresh pear, muddle some fresh pear, swap in the quebranta here for your base distillate, and just a nice little touch of bitters and a nice, I would go with a dry vermouth, and I just think that would be a nice savory winter martini variation. I'm going to have to try that after we get off the air.
Oh my God. I was like, wait, please repeat. I have got to get up, grab a pen and paper.
Oh, we'll, after we get off the air, we'll review. I could be coming up with something terrible here, but it just sounds great. Well, how about this,
no.
Lizzie? Let's.
But you know what? I will have to tell you, I think you're right on the money actually leading with the idea of a martini, because I feel like I always surprise people when I tell them that if you go to the Pisco Valley, oftentimes you will see the grape fields alternating with olive fields. So the same kind of terroir and profile where those olives grow are grapes. And the beautiful thing about it, actually, is that I actually have two different ways of drinking my martinis. If I want them neat, I actually prefer my martinis with La Diablada because I love the aromatics that come through from the Torrentella and Muscatella and Italia in our blend. However, I am really a dirty martini sort of girl.
Okay.
And for that, I use the quebranta because it stands up so well to the olive.
Yeah.
To the olive rind.
Yeah, and the saline kind of note and the savory note, that makes sense too.
Completely. And whenever I've made it for somebody, they're like, they've been blown away. They've been just blown away. Just because you've got a little bit of a difference of the quebranta coming through, but not too much, and the olives are still there. But you know it's not vodka, you know it's not gin, but you're just kind of like, whoa, what is this? It's amazing. Give it a try.
That's a great idea. Okay, we're going to do that. We're gonna circle back on our notes here, Lizzie. Lizzie, listen, we've got about 2.5 minutes before we have to close out the radio portion. You're going to stick around for the podcast portion. But very quickly, let's talk about the La Diablada just in a couple minutes. So it's an acholado. It's a blend.
Sure.
Four grapes. It's very floral, I think is a great way to put
it. Yeah. Absolutely. I think especially when people taste them side by side, they're like, whoa. In fact, most people's reaction is that a Pisco? To mm-hmm. them say yes. You know, especially going from the quebranta to the La Diablada. And as I said earlier, really it was a lot of inspiration for this blend came from Grandma because Grandma this year would have been 103. So Grandma was alive and drinking her Pisco before the agricultural revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the times when aromatic grapes were really grown and more abundantly. Obviously, things change and gravitated more towards some of the sturdier grapes, which are the non-aromatics. And it was really my grandmother who said to my sister, you really need to explore these aromatic grapes and start bringing them back. And that's really why we led with our blend.
Okay.
To allow those grapes to shine and to be known. Not just, you know, a super, because Quebranta on its own can really pack a punch to some people in terms of flavor profile. Some people actually who love the Machu Picchu tend to be silver agave tequila lover.
That makes sense.
Yeah, people who gravitate towards La Diablada tend to have a preference for gin.
That makes sense, too. It's more of those kind of aromatics. I get a bit of sort of vanilla on it. I actually get an orange blossom note on both the nose and the palate on it that are very prevalent as well.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. And using some orange blossom with it in a cocktail is delish.
Oh, that's great. That sounds awesome. Well, hey, Lizzie, let's do this.
Yeah.
Do me a favor, because we have about 45 seconds left. Tell people where they can find you on Facebook, on Instagram, and the website. And then, of course, you're going to stick around. We're going to talk a little bit more on the podcast stuff. But where can people find you online?
Yeah, so our website is machupisco.com. That's also our Facebook name. Our Insta is machu, M-A-T-T-H-U, underscore pisco. That's pisco like disco, but with a P.
Okay, perfect. Awesome. So what we're going to do, friends, is we're going to close out the radio portion here of the NOLA Drink Show right now. But as I said, Lizzie's going to stick around for another shot with NOLA Drinks. We're going to talk a little bit more about the La Diablada, which is really, really great stuff. And we're going to get a little bit more information about some stuff about what it's like to be women in the industry, talk a little bit more about the agriculture and environmental stuff, sustainability that they're working on at Machu Picchu. So friends here, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until then, cheers, y'all. Everybody, thanks for sticking around for another shot with NOLA Drinks. Hope you are enjoying the conversation that we're having with Lizzie Asher from Machu Picchu. And we're going to continue that conversation with some more interesting stuff, talking about issues of sustainability culturally as well as environmentally, and some issues as it relates to being women in the industry with her and her sister running a brand. Some very interesting insight coming up here. And then I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. All right, everybody, here we are. Yep, another shot with NOLA Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. As you know, we are chatting with Lizzie Asher of Machu Picchu and having a wonderful time chatting with you here today, Lizzie. I really appreciate it. And kind of when we left off the radio portion and that part of the podcast portion, we were getting into the La Diablada and we talked about the flavor profile. It's an achelado, which means it's a blend of grapes, and in your case, four grapes, the Quebranta, the Moscatel, the Italia, and the Torrentel. But also, I think it's a really, I mean, the bottle's really beautiful. It's a really cool bit of packaging. And I wanted to understand I was guessing there was an association to some degree with the word devil, which is Diablo in Spanish. But what is the name? Where does that come from? I think there's a cool story behind it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty cool. So I'm glad that you have an inkling that it might be. So La Diablada. A lot of people do think immediately, the Diablo. That is only actually half the story. La Diablada is actually a dance that is danced in the Andes during carnival time. And it's a dance between angels and demons. So if you look closely at the bottle, the label on the right-hand side of it is the devil mask. But behind the devil, you see a little angel peeking, you know, above his shoulder.
Okay, I see it now. Yeah.
And so my sister really gravitated towards the La Diablada dance because, as we were saying earlier, there are four different grapes in each bottling of a La Diablada Achelado. And the La Diablada dance represents actually the tug of war that happens between angels and demons. That's actually a really great idea because I think that so often we try to be our best self, be better and, beat down our devilish sides. But the idea of the La Diablada dance is really establishing a balance between the devil and your angel side.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
So it's
kind of acknowledging that all of us have the ability to have both of those sides coexist within us, but really reach a balance. And my sister loved that idea of balance, especially because we have four grapes, and she just thought any one of them at any given point could really have taken over the profile and character of our La Diablada. But she wanted them all to sing in harmony. And in order for them to do that really meant establishing a very precise balance. And the really interesting thing about our La Diablada, I think, is that oftentimes people have asked me, well, okay, so what's your formula? And in fact, we don't have a formula for our La Diablada because we believe from year to year, the harvests are different, yielding different grapes. So that's why I said before, Grandma always tasted every blend before it was bottled, after 2 years of resting, to make sure it had just hit that note. And, so Melanie strives to recreate what the La Diablada profile is, and we don't just simply work off a formula that we could just give to anybody and, have them make it.
Yeah.
And so this is blending season now, which requires Melanie to be down there and really seeing the evolution of each of the eau de vies on its own before marrying them together.
That's really cool. So we're kind of what we're talking about here. I'll put in terms for some people. It's like a blended scotch in a sense that you're going for a specific flavor profile and consistency year in and year out. And there is the art of blending in the distillate world, right? I think that's really cool. That's really interesting.
Yeah, you actually pretty much nailed it. As I said earlier, there are three styles of Pisco, but when I speak to most people, because the third style is not very easily found in the U.S. yet, but people know puros and people know achelados, the blends and the single malts. I always go to scotch. Do you like single malts or do you like your blend? Mm-hmm. And what are you looking for to drink?
Right. And I think we can kind of compare it to the same way to wine. If you're not a scotch drinker, this makes sense as well. We could say, look at, say, our Bordeaux, which are predominantly going to have Cab Sauv, Cab Franc, and Merlot, in some combination. Or we could look at a single varietal Cabernet from Napa. And I know it's kind of oversimplification, but I think there's a similar thing there too, where trying to achieve a consistent flavor profile when you're dealing with an agricultural product that varies from vintage to vintage, it's challenging. And I want to make sure we're giving credit where credit is needed to be given, in that there's an art then in maintaining that consistency that your sister is working to deliver on.
Yeah, and also it's really important to know that there are many different ways to make the achelado. There isn't one prescribed way. I mean, you could make the achelado at distillation, meaning you put in,
Yep.
You put all the grapes in then, at fermentation, are you even fermenting them together?
Right.
But as I said, my sister is surgical at every step of the way. So each grape is completely different than the other. She won't even treat the aromatic grapes, even though they're lumped into one category, the same. For her, the Muscatel is completely different than the Italian. The Italian is completely different than the Torrentel. So she keeps them each separate, respecting their identity and character, up until the last moment when, you know, she does blend them and bring them together. And that's her approach to blending.
So just so we're clear, so what you're saying, Lizzie, then, is that these are not co-fermented. They're fermented separately, and then they're distilled separately, and then they're blended, right? Do I have that correct?
Correct.
Okay, that's very interesting, because I think, just as you said, people may expect, oh, we're going to throw them all in together and distill them all together, or excuse me, ferment them all together, and then, you know, something like that, or maybe we ferment them separate, but then we distill them all together. You are keeping them separate until the very end, until the final blend here.
Absolutely.
Very cool.
And in fact, because we do that, and we have taken some of our wonderful supporters and bartenders across the country who are big La Diablada lovers. We've taken them down to Peru during blending season for them to understand the art of blending. As you said, you know, there's master distiller, there's distillation time. But for people who love La Diablada, understanding the blending is an entirely different ball of wax. And mm-hmm. when we've taken them, they're like, okay, this is a little bit harder than we thought. You know, it's like, you're going for a precise nose, you're going for a certain type of body at the same time, you're going for a certain type of flavor profile. You know, working through all of that doesn't just happen, you know, as I said, following a strict mathematical formula.
Sure, you can't do it that way, and that's where the art comes in. Well, and a quick question, then I want to move on to a different topic here real quick. So because of that, I'm guessing that at times you end up with certain, I'll call it leftovers, right? You didn't use everything of each of the four varietals. Do you guys do, like, small puto productions of things that you have left over that maybe we don't see in the States, or stuff that you guys just kind of play around with and enjoy drinking for fun yourselves?
Well, we do actually. So some of those bartenders who came down, some of them started saying, hey, I want some La Diablada, or hey, I want, you know, some Muscatel. And in some states in the U.S., we have introduced our single varietal aromatics under the La Diablada label.
Oh, okay.
Because those are the components of the La Diablada. So we have brought to the U.S., in D.C., in New York, in Illinois, and in California, the Italia and the Muscatel.
Ah, cool. Okay, I'll have to be on the lookout. We'll talk later, because I'm in Louisiana, so I'll have to wait. But I'll hit you up for something moving forward, because I want to check those out. Well, let me ask you this, Lizzie, and something that we touched on. I want to make sure the listeners get to hear you tell this, even if we save more of the story for another time. You know, we know that in many instances, the liquor industry, and I think even the Pisco industry, can be perceived as being male dominated. You know, what's it like, and how important is it to you and your sister to be women in the industry, and especially as a team running a company in the industry? Can you share some of your thoughts on that with us?
No, gladly. It is an adventure. For sure, there are more women, fortunately, behind the bar. I think it's amazing what we're seeing happening there. And, you know, I applaud all the incredibly talented women that we're so excited to see them being represented. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, where we are lagging with women actually is with having some women leading the charge in, for example, like us. We are Melanie, was the founder of our company, right? This is her idea. This is her baby. We don't have as many women in the boardroom, if you will.
Right.
And that's really for us, I would say, where we see the gender discrepancy more often than not. I mean, I will tell you one time I was visiting one of our distributors, and it was before one of these annual tasting shows, you know, that they put together. And some of the vendors, or some of the suppliers rather, and vendors had been invited to the CEO's house. And one of the top persons in my distributor actually turned to me and said, yeah, so what are you doing here? and I think it's because what very few people realize is we are a really small company. So at any given time, you will see Melanie and I tasting at liquor stores. We go to bars and we taste people on our product. We do everything. We interface with absolutely anybody and everybody. And we always say, you know, if you've got a problem with a product, you pick up the phone and call us. It'll get resolved that second. But I think because the gentleman was like, oh, you must be the salesperson, you know, the marketing coming here to just pour. And I'm like, I'm the president of the company. you know, and I know I'm all a 5 foot tall with like a lot of curls and all, and like super Latina and my 6-inch heels. But, you know, it's like, I've got a Harvard Law degree, buddy, you know. You don't want to really get down to it. So that tends to happen surprisingly more often than not. And I've got to give you major kudos for not actually leading with a question that we do often hear, which is, so did you inherit this, or did your dad used to do this?
Oh, wow. Okay, right.
Yeah. Yeah, believe it or not, it happens more often than not.
I'm not surprised. I mean, and I hate to say that, but I'm totally not surprised.
Yeah, so that's where I would say we still lack some women, you know, and I would say also likewise within the higher ranks of distributorship. There are some great women out there in the sales force for some of these distributorships. You know, it'd be great to see some more women who are brand managers and business managers and VPs up there, and you don't see that either on the distribution side.
Lizzie, I think you're absolutely correct in that. You know that we're seeing more bartenders. I think we just had actually one of your quote-unquote neighbors on not that long ago, Lisa Wicker, who is the master distiller at Widow Jane Distillery over in Brooklyn, was on the show. And, you know, I think we're seeing more brand ambassadors, for example, but in the boardroom, to use your term, which I think is very accurate, there's still a ways to go on that front.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. And I think when we are seen, we're just thought of as maybe the PR marketing side of things. Because that's where in years before that has been kind of the growth segments of where women have been, you know, allowed to have a more expansive role, rather than really processing the Excels and negotiating the contracts.
Right. Wow. Okay. So let me ask you this really quick, Lisa, that's who we had on a couple weeks ago. Lizzie, excuse me.
So, that's okay. We both begin with Al.
Yeah. There. And you're both in New York. So I'll let that go. We'll talk about this more. We'll have you back on the show. But environmental consciousness and sustainability is something that's very important to your company. And you guys are working really hard to pay a living wage. You mentioned that to me before we went on the air, that you're working with independent farmers. You all don't own any vineyards in particular. So how you work with the supply chain, how you compensate people, and understanding who's working the field all the way until we enjoy something in the bottle is something that's critical to your business model.
Yes. Absolutely. And as I was saying before, I mean, our goal is to get as many people drinking Pisco as possible and discovering its magic. I think you discover the magic of Pisco, you begin to discover the magic of what, you know, Peru has to offer. And in order to get people hooked onto Pisco, we believe that we have to make a great quality product at a great price. Mm-hmm. So we, as mindful as we are to be, you know, of great value, we believe that that doesn't mean you can't also have the ethos of being mindful to the environment and also paying fair wages. And that, to us, means that, you know, we are not trying to put out there just a rock-bottom price. We're trying to put out what we know in our conscience is the right thing to do for all the co-op farmers that we work with, for all the women, grape pickers who come and help us every year at harvest, and whose teenage daughters, we've seen them grow, who sometimes unfortunately are not able to graduate from high school. Some moms who come with their newborns strapped on their back and they're still grape picking. If you were down there during harvest season, you know how hardworking every one of these people are.
Yep.
And, you know, just sometimes when people are trying to get 2 cents less on their ounce pour. I'm like, well, 2 cents won't break your back. It could break somebody else's that, you know, really deserves it more along the production line and more specifically down in Pisco Valley land. So
that's a great point.
That is something to be mindful of.
Yeah, Lizzie, thank you. Because that's a really important point. If you're talking about trying to peel away 2 cents from somebody's wages versus, as you made the point before we went on the air, we know this with lots of products, you're selling, you're getting, say, 12 pours or more out of a bottle if you're putting it in a cocktail, and what you're paying, you know, a patron's paying $12, $13. We're talking about pennies on the dollar here to pay what is a living wage in that part of the world. Let's not beat those people up. We should all understand something like Pisco. It's a special product. It's a product from terroir, as we've noted. Terroir ties into culture. You should expect to pay a premium from something that comes with this kind of heritage and comes, frankly, with this kind of limited production space, meaning the area in which it's grown is very small and has such deep cultural ties. You should pay a premium for this. That's my opinion anyway.
Well, I think it's a very learned and wise opinion, if I may add.
Oh, thank you. I don't hear that very often.
and trust me, my husband wishes that I would say that about him. but you know, in all fairness, you know, and I think that's what life a little bit is about. Do you know what I mean? We want to be able to toast and enjoy life and be able to celebrate with some amazing cocktails and great products. And while we're enjoying and celebrating our lives, let's hope that what we are imbibing and drinking, you know, is also allowing other people who produce it to also enjoy and live life with gusto. Not that we're putting nooses around their necks so we can get something, as I said, just minimally cheaper just because.
Yep, perfect. Well said, Lizzie. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to chat with you today. Thanks for taking time, and we'll do it again soon. I really appreciate it.
Oh, looking forward to it, Brian. Salud.
Salud. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude, and I will be back with my parting shot. Hey, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Lizzie Asher of Machu Pisco. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time talking with her, as you probably gathered. Wanted to mention a couple things real quick. Talked about this at the top of the show. Got some pretty cool stuff coming up here on the program here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to be chatting with Neil Bodenheimer and Caroline Rosen, two-thirds of the leadership team of Tales of the Cocktail. Lots of cool stuff going on with those guys. Really excited to get them back on the show, as always. Tales of the Cocktail is doing some really good things now that we have a transition, have a new leadership team in place. They're doing Tales on Tour. It's when they take the big conference that happens here in New Orleans every July on the road. This year, they're going to Puerto Rico. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about really how they're kind of continuing to reimagine and reevaluate what Tales of the Cocktail is and should be. Really a lot of fun to chat with them. And yeah, I want you to check that out. Really good stuff. We're going to talk to Paul Hletko, who is the founder of Few Spirits up there in Illinois, a very fine distiller, really cool guy. He was on the show last year during Tales of the Cocktail, actually about a year and 3 months ago, 2 months ago or so. You'd have Paul back on. Super entertaining conversation coming up there. We're going to talk about Revillon dinners and the Revillon tradition here in New Orleans and some stuff, if you're in this area or coming to visit this area, that you can do to kind of check out the reboot, if you will, of that really cool tradition. We're going to have an historian on talking about the tradition. We're going to talk with our friends from French Quarter Festival who are putting on all kinds of events going on during the month of December to honor the Revillon tradition. Going to be really cool. And we've got our French Quarter Festival series coming up where we're going to interview musicians partnering up with that fine festival and that fine group. Really exciting stuff emerging from that. We'll have more of that coming soon. But friends, hey, we're here on the Parting Shot on the NOLA Drink Show. You know, one of the things that actually really matters to me a lot, we throw that term terroir around quite a bit. And terroir, you know, I think most of us out there listening probably, if you're listening to this show, you probably know what it is, right? We're talking about the growing conditions for things like grapes. It applies to things like agave. It applies to really the concept of any agricultural product made into beverage or really food for that matter or anything else. It's very often, of course, associated with wine, but that definition has broadened to really talk about a lot of things. Now, most often we associate that term with climate. soil type, environmental conditions, the ecology, if you will, behind the growing conditions. But actually an accepted part, and to me, a very important part of what terroir is actually the people, the cultural component of all this. It really is a part of it. That's the definition that I want to use. That's something that is part of this to me. And I think if things like agricultural products, like spirits, like wine, these things are important to you, that sense of provenance from where they come matters, then you have to include people in your definition of terroir. Now, this is one of the reasons why I really like talking about Pisco, why we did the show with Lizzie today. You know, we've talked about Mezcal a lot on this show, and I invite you to go back and just go to our search bar on NOLADrinks.com, put in Pisco, put in Mezcal. You see a whole bunch of shows in times past that address this. Terroir, the agriculture, obviously is a significant part of this, as I just said. The people and cultural part of this is what I just said. When we talk about something like Pisco, we talk about something like Mezcal, the political and social import in these places, in Peru, the history of Pisco, what it has meant to that country culturally, the re-envisioning of really the rise of the culinary scene and the rise of Pisco, basically with this backdrop of the political turmoil that they had that almost killed the Pisco industry in the 80s and really into the 90s with the Shining Path and other things. And things we've talked about with Mezcal, the threats to agave production, the threats to the traditional way of doing things. These are important parts of that beverage, and this is why I really like to talk about it. You heard Lizzie say that, for example, her grandmother was the inspiration for the achelado, the blended pisco that we have. We know when we think about mezcal in that part of Mexico where people enjoy mezcal and have for decades longer, really, you know, for anniversaries, for funerals, for birthdays. There's a village making mezcal, and that's what people drink to celebrate or honor certain things in their culture. That is part of terroir. The traditional methodology of making things, how you go about making them, why they taste the way they do, why all of this matters, why the process matters is part of this. You know, in many ways, you really can't cut corners to make it right. It's not going to be the same. There are also ethical reasons to support these people and those methods. I think that's really important too. So that gets me really to this point that I want to get to here. Price. Now, I was at Tales of the Cocktail three months ago, and the Peruvian government put on this really wonderful lunch that they do. And it's, you know, they're really behind Pisco as the national beverage, national spirit, and putting some money behind it. The trade agency, their commerce is behind it, and so on. They put on this really great event. And we were having lunch, and I was sitting at a table with a bunch of different folks. And one guy was arguing, and he's in the Pisco business, and he was arguing that Pisco needs to be $15 a bottle. And he's talking retail, so that it can be in every bartender's well if it's going to actually be successful. Now, to me, I said to him, hey, that's not going to happen, and it really shouldn't in my view. Let's look at it this way. If it's going to be in your well, it's got to be super cheap, right? It's going to compete with vodka, gin, certain whiskeys, things like that. Going to be really common, needingly so, to be very common in a number of cocktails that you typically are making. To me, that is missing the idea. And I actually argued, look at Mezcal as a model. And this is certainly not a perfect model. Again, we've talked about that on past shows. But kind of where that's going, or we can even look at premium spirits, some of the so-called, you know, premium tequilas that are out there. Again, don't want to go too far down this road because it is not really a perfect model. Still lots of problems to be addressed there. But you can't mass produce this stuff. You know, grapes and agave take time to produce. With grapes, we have a vintage. With agave, in many cases, you know, we're talking about mezcal here, obviously, that it takes years for the piñas to actually mature and be ready to be used in producing mezcal. In these areas, there is limited land available, for example, to actually produce these things within what is a zone, an appellation, whatever you want to call it, an area that we label where these products, Pisco or mezcal, come from. Now, sure, people can expand these areas. They can expand the geography. But if you do that, is it really Pisco or Mezcal? Is it still really connected to the terroir? Meaning, is it really connected to the cultural component of what makes these drinks? Point is, another point here is that you can't really just rush willy-nilly to plant more in other areas and then call it the same thing. To me, you've disassociated yourself from that part of what actually makes terroir terroir. Think about Bordeaux wines, right? You know, yeah, you can go plant Cabernet Franc and Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot in neighboring areas, But is that really still going to be Bordeaux? Is that still going to be really what you expect it to be? There's a tradition there of terroir that includes the climate, but it includes the culture, the people, and the sense of place. My other concern is that if you're going to actually expand these areas, because that was what was being mentioned by this guy, is, well, we can just grow more grapes to make Pisco in other areas of Peru. Well, what's to protect some of the traditional production methods and those who make it? Is that going to really endure? To me, this is all part of this. Now, look, I'm not trying to be anti-modernization, but there is a big difference between mass production and not. There are certainly parts of the process that can be modernized sensibly in ways that don't remove or actually replace that element, if you will, from the process. Sure, lots to unpack there and lots we could probably argue about there. I'm not telling people to make their job harder than what it is, but some of these traditional methodologies make the drink what it is, make it taste what it how it does, but also really make it what it is in the spirit. And to me, that actually matters. But also really what matters here too is people's livelihoods matter. So fair pricing and fair trade, these are also not necessarily perfect models. Lots of work to do there, but it's a start because it actually acknowledges people's need to make a living and a fair living off what these things really should cost. And that's the point that I want to make too, is that if you're talking about Pisco needing to be $15 a bottle to be successful, retail to be successful, it's not going to happen. The foundation is not there. And I think you're missing the mark of where you need to go to create something quite different. Hence why I mentioned that Mezcal model. Pisco and Mezcal should cost more money. To protect the cultural traditions of how they're made, to protect the terroir, to protect the environment, to protect the raw environmental ingredients, the agave, the grapes, these sorts of things. These things need to cost a premium. This is not stuff that we're talking about mass producing like Anheuser-Busch. It doesn't work to preserve what those beverages are. And part of that is, I think that is kind of clear. But part of what I'm talking about here too is that people component, that people need to make a living wage. This is an ethical thing to do, and this is actually required to be sustainable. If you want to keep your industry going, if you want to continue to have Pisco be what Pisco is, if you want to continue to have Mezcal be what Mezcal is, then the people that factor into that equation, how they make it and how they earn their livelihood and exist with these culturally integrated beverages, I'm going to call them that, just made up that term, they need to be treated fairly. Lizzie mentioned in the interview about Pisco that they have workers that come and pick grapes in the fields with babies strapped to their backs. And people are arguing over the cost that they're paying labor and paying a fair wage. Realistically, we're really talking about pennies or cents on the dollar. That really shouldn't matter too much when we're paying for $12 or $13 or $14 in this country, in the United States or in the developed world, for a cocktail, or really should be paying $25 or $30 or $35 or $40 for a bottle of Pisco or more for a bottle of Mezcal. A living wage is really part of allowing this traditional view and its connection to the culture to be maintained. And to me, frankly, that is an integral part of terroir. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.